I am Plant Online. This is thecommentary.ca. Karen Connolly joins me now. The noted author and poet writes a love story, one that involves herself. In the late 1990s, she is in Burma amidst the student demonstrations against the military junta. She then falls in love with a man who is giving his life to the struggle for political change. The book is called Burmese Lessons, a love story. Karen Connolly is the author of 9 books, including The Lizard Cage, a book that the New York Times Book Review compared to the works of Solzhenitsyn, Mandela, and Orwell. Another book, Touch the Dragon, won the Governor General's Award for nonfiction. This book is published by Random House. The website for more is karenconnolly.ca. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Karen Connolly. Good morning, Ms. Connolly.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. How many languages do you speak?
Well, it's up for discussion, really. My Burmese, embarrassingly enough, is not fluent. It's okay once I've been around for a while in Burma, but I speak 5 other languages fluently. So
I'd hazard a guess that you primarily write and think in English?
I certainly write in English, but I spend quite a bit of time thinking in Greek because I speak to my son in Greek. I kind of live in Greek in a domestic way. So I think a lot in Greek.
I read somewhere that you have a house in Greece.
I have that really should say shack. I have a shack. I have a little tiny stone house there, yes.
How much time do you spend there?
Well, now that I'm in Canada promoting this book, I'm not spending much time there at all. Maybe 2 months a year, sometimes 3. It kind of depends on what's happening in the moment. But, you know, I try and go back every year for a couple months, definitely.
I only speak one language. Well, I barely speak English.
you seem to be doing pretty well.
Yeah. Do you think in another language? I'm always interested when people say they're multilingual, whether they think in another language or not.
Well, in fact, I was just having a conversation about this with Danny Leferrier.
Yeah.
And I think that if you're fairly proficient to fluent in another language, as soon as you start speaking it, you begin to think in it. And it's quite a fascinating process because when you're using other words, when your body, your mouth, your brain is actually using this other set of vocabulary, it changes you, in fact. You think in another way. You might even, if you've lived in the country of the language, you might even adopt other mannerisms, physical mannerisms. The actual change in language is a change in body as well, and it's fascinating. That's one of the reasons why I love speaking other languages, is because it's such a powerful, visceral experience.
How did you end up in Burma?
I went to Burma the first time, partly because I was very interested in the case of a young woman writer who had been imprisoned for 20 years in solitary confinement. I mean, that was her sentence. She hadn't been in that long yet. She'd been maybe in prison for 4 or 5 years when I found out about her. And her crime was writing short stories that were critical of the military regime. Her name is Matida, and happily, years later, she was, in fact, amnestied and released, and I met her, and I was just talking to her a few days ago. We became quite good friends, but that's the original reason. I wanted to find out more about Matida's situation. We shared many similarities. We were both young women, writers, you know, in our late 20s, interested in social justice issues, and I was free, living my adventurous life, and Matida was in solitary confinement in a prison in Burma. So I was just really struck by the accident of geography that defines a life, and it made me curious about her, it made me curious about Burma. And once I had gone that first time, I was hooked. I fell in love with Burma.
And was that around the time that you were in Thailand as well?
No, I had in fact been living in Thailand, but my first long sojourn in Thailand was when I was 17 and 18. I was an exchange student, and I lived in the north with a Thai family. But then I went back 10 years later, and I was working on a documentary project in Thailand, and that was the first time that I went to Burma in 1996.
Now, when you go there in 1996, this military regime that's been in place there, that's been there since the 60s, hasn't it?
It has, since 1962. Someone named General Ne Win staged a coup d'etat. The democracy government was pretty shaky, and the coup d'etat the coup d'etat went over very well, and for the next until 1988, he was the only dictator. And in 1988, when there were extraordinary million-strong protests across Burma, people, demonstrators protesting against the military regime, he handed power over to a group of his friends and cronies, a group of generals, and he was getting very old. He was in his 80s at the time. And he handed power over to a body that was called the SLORC, the State Law and Order Restoration Council. And eventually that band of men changed their names to something a little bit more friendly, a little less Orwellian. But, of course, it's more Orwellian. The government that rules Burma now is called the State Peace and Development Council. But, as I said, that's even more Orwellian than SLORC, which at least was bit more honest.
This may seem like a stupid question, and I can't promise it'll be the only one I'll ask, but after so long, since the 60s, and then certainly in the last, you know, number of years when we hear about it more, do you think that people in Burma, that they're perhaps, I don't know if used to it, seems like a stupid word, but that they've not accepted it even, you know, that it's become sort of that it's inevitable now?
Well, that's not a stupid question. That's a good question.
Day to day, is it something?
No, there's great apathy among people, and there is even in Buddhism somehow there is a sense of acceptance. I mean, that's one of the tenets of Buddhism, that you have to accept the situation, the any given situation, and work within that, and accept the present moment as it is. That's one way of thinking about Buddhism. But as you will remember, in 2007, it was actually the Buddhist Sangha, the monks of Burma, who led extraordinary protests against the ruling dictatorship. So there's a real mixture, as you can imagine. It's a country of 60 million people. There's a profound mixture of feeling, sentiment, thinking towards the military regime. In general, though, I mean, people hate them, especially after Cyclone Nargis. There's great bitterness that senior general Tan Shui didn't help his own people, or it took him so long to allow the international community to help his own people. So there's bitterness and there's great anger. But yes, beside that, there is apathy too, I believe, just a sense of powerlessness sometimes in the face of the regime. Nevertheless, within all of that, there is still a really profound dissident movement in Burma, and there are millions of people who crave and who pray for a change in government. And hopefully that will happen. I am actually very encouraged by the fact that the assistant to the secretary, the assistant secretary of state in the U.S., Kurt Campbell has actually furthered a process of, well, furthered, has begun a process of, between the U.S. and the Burmese junta, of some talks, of some kind of dialogue. That's probably the best sign that's come out of Burma in a long, long time, that an international power is actually going to initiate some kind of dialogue with the ruling members of the junta. It's really good news.
When was the last time you were there?
Oh, I haven't been back since 2001. And even that trip was a bit of an accident. I was very surprised to be able to get a visa. I had been unable to get a visa for several years, and then in 2001 I just somehow lucked out. And since The Lizard Cage has been published, and certainly since Burmese Lessons has been published, I haven't tried to get a visa. And perhaps I could. You never know.
Yeah.
But I think it's a bit unlikely.
Now, what was Burma like for you spiritually? It obviously had an effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to ask about religion, but I mean, it sort of.
That's so Canadian.
Yeah.
Don't hate to ask about religion. That's okay.
I've been very
interested. Not deeply dedicated. I don't consider myself a Buddhist.
Yeah.
But I've certainly my work, my way of living, how I approach all the big ideas, compassion, evil, goodness, human interaction, the notion of betrayal, all of those things I come to with a deeply Buddhist philosophy and quite a Buddhist stance on life. And really, I started to learn and study Buddhism when I was 17 and 18 and first lived in Thailand. And definitely my experiences in Burma reinforced my leanings towards Buddhism. It's a religion and a philosophy, a way of life that I deeply respect and can understand in a way that I've never really been able to do with you know, Christianity, the tradition that I grew up in. So being in Burma, I mean, it's a deeply Buddhist country. There is also, you know, there is Islam and there is Christianity in Burma too, in significant amounts, and even Hinduism. So it's a greatly mixed society. It's a very plural society in that way. But the majority is Buddhist, and Buddhist temples are everywhere, and you see monks every day, and there are shrines all over the city. And so to be in Burma was a great pleasure in that way, because when you're there and you're interested in Buddhism, it's openly accessible. It's a Zeitgeist of the place. And so for me it was wonderful. But I mean, again, wonderful. Wonderful in the context of the brutal military dictatorship that rules the country. You know, one of the passages in Burmese lessons tells the story of these very kind Buddhist monks who are witnessing a protest with me, and when the riot police and the soldiers come, everybody runs away, but I continue standing in the street. I'm very curious about what's going to happen, what the soldiers are going to do, and the Buddhist monks, you know, whisper to me from a dark doorway. They've hidden themselves, but they whisper to me and tell me, you know, you really should get out of the street because we're worried about you. And so I go to them, and they take me through all these back passageways in a very dark neighborhood because electricity is a problem in Burma. And they bring me up this set of rickety stairs, and I don't even really know where we're going, but what they have done is they've brought me to, well, inside their monastery, in fact, and they've brought me to a window, and they allow me, they help me to see what is going to happen, how this protest is going to play out. And together, sitting there, we watch this terrible beating take place almost right below us. And afterwards, because, of course, we can't help the man, we can't call out, we can't do anything, we just have to sit there witnessing what is taking place. And afterwards, when they send me home, they take me back down through the darkness and through these little alleyways and pathways. They give me a box of water biscuits to send me on my journey. And that whole idea of, I mean, they were giving me really an antidote to what I had just seen in the street, to the bloody violence that we had all just witnessed together. They were giving me this gift, a gift of food, you know, the gift of civilization, really. And that's what Buddhism is for me in some ways. I mean, it's a deeply civilized philosophy of how humans can be better, how humans can be good. And not just humans in a way, because of course it's a very holistic philosophy of life. It gives us good reason to be compassionate to all sentient beings. And you know, I mean, obviously that passage is in the book, but even now as I speak of it, I get a bit choked up because it was such a profound moment of human interaction. You know, that sense of, okay, we've seen this horrific thing, we've seen this together, we've witnessed what it is, we've witnessed what evil is, and here in this gesture, I give you the opposite. And that's really, for me, what Buddhism is. You know, the opposite of evil. It's this deep belief in the goodness of humans.
Yeah. Now, the food in Burma, is that good?
It is very good. Hard to find good Burmese food outside of Burma, except among Burmese people. I mean, I'm talking about restaurants and things. It's not that the cuisine hasn't, like many other things in Burma, the cuisine has not been allowed to get out of the country. You know, it too has been imprisoned in a way, but it's very delicious, very delicious cuisine, very varied, very different than Thai, for example. Other flavors, other idioms of spices and herbs, you know, it's very delicious.
Yeah, a lot of the reviews of your book and articles about you make mention that you prefer the name Burma to what it's called elsewhere, Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't say why.
Well, I do talk about that a little bit, actually, in the book. In 1989, the military government, the new military government, the SLORC, in an attempt to, really in an attempt to align themselves with the old historical rightful kings of Burma, the monarchy that ruled Burma in the past, they went through the country and they changed a lot of the more modern names to older names. And Myanmar is one of those words, one of those names. Bama is in fact a Burmese word and it refers to Burma. The spelling is an anglicization, certainly. But the point being, in fact, that the military government did not consult the populace about any of the name changes. And so, again, it was another imposition that the military put upon the people. So people who do political dissident work and people who are aware of that history still tend to call the country by its former name, Burma.
I also read that there's a lot of sex in this book. Is that people who've read the book, is that what they're talking about?
There is some sex. I mean, I had a very passionate and very important relationship, not in Burma, but on the Thai-Burma border with the leader of a dissident, at that time, in fact, it was a paramilitary organization. So the leader of a guerrilla army, we were together for several months, not even a year, but it was a serious relationship. We talked about getting married and having children. I was very, very in love with him. And that's partly what the book is about. It's about that relationship and the decisions that it forced me to make about who I wanted to be in the world. So yeah, there is some sex in the book, but it's good sex.
Yeah.
Not bad sex. It's very good.
Is that the guy on the cover?
No, that is not the guy on the cover.
No.
No.
How do you pronounce the guy's name? Mao?
Mao.
Yeah. Well, what do you think attracted him to you? I mean, do you think about that?
It's a good question. I think, frankly, the initial attraction was beauty, but I was also very, very interested in Burma and very, very sincere about my desire to do something. What that something would be, I didn't even know at the time, but I was extremely sympathetic. I was extremely empathetic and willing to be involved. And part of the willingness to be involved, you know, led us both to fall madly in love with each other. And likewise, I mean, I was also very attracted to him. It was a strong physical attraction from the start. And then what was happening with Burma and the dissident politics and the foment of that time, I mean, it's a very, very stressful, very difficult living on the border, living in that reality, but it also pushes people together. I mean, you excuse me, you are joined by a cause, and that's a very, very powerful thing, to be joined by a cause, not just to a lover or a boyfriend or whatever, but to other people as well. That's an incredible glue, and so we were certainly not immune to that. I mean, you want that in a way. You want to be joined. You want to be connected that way.
And he's, I've read somewhere that he's got a family of his own now?
He is married now. I don't actually think that he's had children, but he's married and his life has changed. He's no longer the leader of a paramilitary organization. And this is something that was happening when we were together already. He saw the hopelessness, basically, of leading this guerrilla war against the military government, because the Burmese military machine is huge. It greatly outnumbers the military forces that, you know, the people who believe in democracy have. And over the years, there have been more and more ceasefire agreements with the different ethnic groups that traditionally, for over half a century now, have been fighting for their autonomy and language rights against the Burmese regime. He saw early on that the ethnic war and that the guerrilla wars were not going to bring change, and he wanted to start trying to be a dissident, to be a diplomat, and in a way also to prepare for the change that will inevitably come to Burma. So that is what he does now. He's really a professional dissident.
Did he know that you wrote about this relationship you had?
He does. Yeah, I did. We did communicate about it, and he gave me a kind of reluctant blessing. But obviously, it's my story, not his. So, you know, that I always recognize that as a tremendous power. And I don't know if he'll read the book. I kind of hope he doesn't, actually.
Yeah. You received the Governor General's Prize at an early age. Do you think getting that validation, that success early on, do you think that was a good thing?
You know, everything is always mixed. It was a good thing, for sure, and it gave me money and sold me a lot of books, which also gave me money, which just established me and enabled me to have a few years of free writing, really. I mean, I didn't have to worry about making a living from anything else, which is, of course, what we do most of the time, writers, I mean.
Yeah.
But it was also, you know, it was also quite destabilizing and made me question the connection between making art and selling it, because people get quite rabid when there's a little bit of fame around, and it, you know, even a small, tiny drop of fame makes people kind of hungry, and I felt rather consumed by attention and by demands on me, and I was very young, so when you're very young, you're certainly not prepared for that kind of attention. It's the last thing that was in my mind. You know, I was sort of ready for the long, slow struggle, and of course, the long, slow struggle has come,
yeah.
Because that's what happens. I mean, you can win a prize, but in a few years, sometimes people forget about that, and particularly in my case, because one of my reactions to all of that attention, and part of my life too, was to leave the country again. So even after I won the prize, I left Canada and didn't really use it the way that writers will now, and good on them that they do, because we need to use those things. But I kind of put it behind me in a strange way. That's kind of what I needed to do when I was younger. And I also think that in some ways it affects the work I have done now. Like, I think I'm going to be given another literary award until I'm deep in my 50s or maybe my 60s, just because, you know, it's a jealous and envious field, and there aren't enough pieces of pie for everybody, and I know that there are still some people who are pretty irritated that I won the award when I was, you know, barely out of high school.
Yeah.
But that's fine. That's okay. I've gotten over that, too.
I understand that you're writing a book of poetry about the downtown east side here in Vancouver.
It's partly about. It has some poems in it, but in a broader sense, it certainly is about the sex trade and addiction and the invisibility of people who we don't want to see.
And is that the only thing that you're working on at the moment, or?
I've also got another novel in the works, a novel that I believe begins in Thailand and will probably end in Calgary, the city where I was born and raised.
Now, as a writer, do you find that you read perhaps more than someone who's not a writer?
Oh yes, I'm an addict, a reading addict.
And
I love reading. I love books.
And it informs the writing, obviously, right?
It does. It does, I think, in subtle ways sometimes. I mean, I remember when I was younger, I used to really quickly pick up people's writing styles, but that doesn't seem to happen anymore, which is a good thing, because my own style, my own way of approaching language has solidified somewhat. Not, I guess it doesn't ever solidify. It's always very fluid, but I have my own voice now. So I think that you're influenced by people's skill. Like, you, when you're a writer and you're reading, you're studying how they do it. How did they do it? How did they make that happen? How did they make me believe this? What was the actual technique? And to a certain extent, you can study that, and of course, to another certain extent, it's all magic, right? When it works, it's some magical, ineffable, intangible trick that, you know, you either absorb or figure out on your own, or you don't.
Do you write on a computer?
I do. Yeah, I do. I don't really write poetry on the computer, at least not the first drafts. But if the first draft is in somehow, if I've done a first draft on paper with poetry, I can put it into the computer and then start tinkering. But if I ever get stuck in prose or in poetry, I write longhand. Like if it's not working, or if it feels funny, or if I just need to make a few notes, I'll often write longhand. I certainly keep a lot of notes in longhand.
Karen, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you, and I told you at the outset I hadn't read the book, but this just sounds like a book that I'll want to read, and so I do plan to go to the bookshop this weekend and buy it. Continued good luck with the book.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Burmese Lessons, A Love Story. Random House Canada is its publisher. Karen Connolly on the line, its author. Her website is karenconnolly.ca, incidentally. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.